This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
I'm Andrew Johnstone, and you're listening to The Last Breath, a podcast about death and dying, brought to you by Hospice Waikato and Free FM, the Waikato's community access media organisation. As a society, we seldom talk about death, but as I've learned, given an opportunity, people have a lot to say on the topic. For Series 2 of The Last Breath, I've asked all sorts of people to share their perspectives on death, dying and grief, assisted dying, faith and the afterlife. In this episode, the General Manager of Free FM, Phil Gray, and Auckland-based singer-songwriter Caitlin Smith share their perspectives. I'm sitting with Phil Gray. Phil, you're the General Manager of Free FM, who's been hosting the Last Breath podcast. Mm-hmm. And you're also the chairman of CAMA. Now, what is CAMA?
CAMA is the Community Access Media Alliance. So it's what we call the peak body of the 12 access media organisations or radio stations across New Zealand.
So, Phil, what service do they provide to the community?
Well, we need to differentiate first between what a community radio station is, which is basically anyone wants to create a radio station and say it's a community station can do that. And there are some community radio stations that really genuinely do represent and reflect the communities we're in. But the access stations, the 12 access stations, actually sign up to an agreement and a funding contract with government to deliver on a specific part of New Zealand's Broadcasting Act, which says that whoever's in government will enable the direct involvement in the media by some minorities. Now, this act is pretty old now, so the minorities are actually specifically listed as women, firstly, although not a minority, but underrepresented when the act was written in the 80s. Women, children, youth, the health and disability sector, a range of religious and ethical beliefs, migrant and ethnic communities, very important. And if you look at it with a bit of a liberal bent, then you've also got rainbow community and other less represented parts of our society. So that's the priority, that's the core of what the access stations do. But many of them also have just general community radio content, and a station like Free FM, lots of music content as well.
So I guess The Last Breath fits perfectly into that format.
It really does. It's something that you are unlikely to hear in mainstream media. Now, okay, you might on something like RNZ, but you're not going to hear that sort of thing on the commercial radio stations.
When I heard through your program director, Mike Williams, that Hospice Waikato wanted to do a podcast, but they didn't know how to do it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, perhaps I could be of service to them. So I went out and saw Shereen McCleary, who's the communications manager, and we got to work. And when she told me the subject matter, we're going to be teaching people about dying because it's a conversation that we don't have enough of in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And we're going to call it The Last Breath. I said to her, well, that's very confronting, Cherie. And she said, well, that's the whole point. That's what we're here for. We're here to teach people about dying and not to be afraid of it. It's part, a natural part of life. And I didn't know how it would go down. And when I saw the streaming figures for the first series, I was kind of astonished. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's obviously a lot of people who want to have this conversation.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And part of the success of the show is that we immediately knew that it would be quality. We knew that it was something that there's not a lot of information out there about, not a lot of podcasts, certainly not here in New Zealand, not something that a station had anything like. So we put some decent promotional effort behind it, and the response has been super positive. Yeah.
So, Phil, now we've got that out of the way, I'm here to ask you some deep searching questions. And the first one is, do you ever think about your own death?
I do, and increasingly so. As you get older, I think you see more of it. You see more of it. You're reminded more often of it. And I do find that I think about it, if not daily, then certainly several times a week, I think about it, yeah.
And what do you think?
Well, it's the ultimate natural conclusion of one's time on Earth, isn't it? It's inevitable, and I see a lot of different ways that it's handled, and a lot of different ways that people embrace it personally, from one end of the spectrum being terrified of it and trying to deny it, to the other end, people who are facing their imminent death, facing it with incredible bravery.
How would you like to die? In a perfect world.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you think about, is it better to be taken suddenly and not even be aware of it, or is it better to have some lead time so you can do the things you need to do, whether it's even just sorting out your financial affairs or ensuring that you're not leaving a mess for your family to deal with. And I don't know which I'd prefer. I know that whichever it is, I don't want it to happen yet. Not for quite a long time. But I think I'd rather know it was coming, but not have a long, lingering, uncomfortable end ride, for sure.
How old are you, Phil?
I'm 56. So, hopefully it's a long way off.
Your father, of course, has had a heart bypass a while back, and he recently had a small stroke. I guess that brings it home, doesn't it?
It does, and I'm very lucky that I still have both my parents. And I think that that's part of what makes me think about this perhaps more than the average person, is they're not going to be around forever. But also, being my age and still having my parents, I haven't had that life-changing moment of losing a parent yet. And I often say to friends, I don't know, but I have a feeling that you don't feel grown up until you lose a parent. I don't feel 56 years old. I certainly don't behave it a lot of the time. Sometimes I think my life is just one extended adolescence. And I wonder whether that in part is because I haven't lost a parent, so I haven't stepped into the world as, I'm the senior generation of the family at this point. I don't know. Interested in what other people think about that. Some people look at me oddly and go, okay. But it's just the sense I have, and I won't know until I lose my parents, will I?
Are you contemplating your father's death?
Yeah. Yeah, he's in his 80s. He's still working every day. He's had some health challenges, and we have some big decisions to make in the not-too-distant future around what they're going to do with the remaining time they have, because they are still in the house and property that they've been in for more than 50 years, with responsibilities to staff and the property. It's going to be a big change for the entire family when something happens.
Is your father ready to give up his life?
No. No, he's not. No.
Is he aware that his health is not what it was?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
He's not in denial?
No, he's not in denial. He's doing what he can, and it's not what he used to be able to do, even a couple of years ago. He has shortness of breath and lack of strength to do a lot of the work, relies on other people more and more. But as far as we're concerned as family, if we can enable him to do what he wants to do for as long as possible, then great. But we need to plan for all eventualities.
He
as a family, that's what we're trying to do.
He can't see himself in a retirement village.
Oh, no, definitely not.
A lot of people who are used to living very active physical lives, working in the outdoors. I've heard this before. My own paternal grandfather was the same. There was no way that he was going to leave the farm. And he died on the farm. And he died in the way that you described earlier. He died very suddenly, probably the best kind of death you can have. Mm. Out mm. with the cows, just mm-hmm. drop dead. Mm-hmm. There was no way he was going to move to a retirement village or even into town.
Yep.
If your father moved into town, it might be bad for him.
Yes. Yes, I think my mum would adjust and is certainly open to that, but that's not the best thing for Dad, unless there's absolutely no choice. So we'll just see what time brings us, and hopefully it's kind.
Well, when my grandfather died, his wife, Sylvia, she wanted to retire into town. Mm-hmm. You know, she's mm-hmm. made it very clear. She said, I've been a farmer's wife for 65 years. Mm-hmm. I've done my stint, mm-hmm. and now I want to have an easy life.
Yeah.
And when he died, of course, she was upset, but she also said, now is my chance to be who I am. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. she lived to be 102, wow. quite happily in town in her own unit, right till mm-hmm. right till the end. It's a remarkably similar story.
Mm. Mm, mm. And it's one that a lot of people that have rural upbringings have in common, I think. Most people do make a plan and sell the property or hand it on down the family. That's not going to happen in my family. So the end means liquidating the assets and ensuring that the remaining person gets the best of care and the happiest. The happiest resettlement that is possible. So, you know, we just want to make the plans so we know what the plan B is or the plan C. It just gets enacted at the time that everyone wants it to happen. That there's no reduction in the agency for the people that it most affects. So that's what we're trying to achieve. Mm.
It's been a rough time in your family the last few months. I mean, I won't go into this publicly, but one of your brothers has had some health challenges, and you lost a beloved uncle.
I did, just about three, four weeks ago.
How old was he?
Oh, he was 89, 90, I think. I'd have to double check that.
How did you feel when that happened? First of all, what was your relationship with him?
It's only a fairly recent relationship, to be honest. Never lived in the same city. Had a lot more to do with his kids, or more so his two sons, through some common interests. Great, great people. One of his sons, unfortunately, suffered a number of serious health issues. Firstly, from a horrendous accident. And then a terrible illness, and end up in Waikato Hospital, and called on me in distress, I guess. Needed some company, so I ended up spending a couple of nights with him in his room at Waikato Hospital before some major surgery, just to be there to help with anxiety and. Said my goodbyes on the morning of his surgery and said, look, I'll see you in a couple of days when you're up for visitors and things. And unfortunately, he didn't make it. So I spent some time with the family and my cousin.
How old was he?
My age, 56, I think, 57 maybe. And that brought me closer to them. And I had already established a good relationship with my uncle and would regularly drop in. Just have a cup of tea or beer or sausage roll or whatever. He was living on his own. He had lost his wife. And just really enjoyed his company, and the feeling seemed to be mutual. So I started making sure that whenever he was in a different city, but as I drove through, I would divert my trip, stop at the supermarket, buy a flagon of Good George beer, and drop in there. Well, actually, prior to that, I would always, beer that I made, I'd always take them. But I thought, I can do better than that. I'll buy him some proper beer. And we'd just sit and have a couple of beers together and just have a chat. And it was just really, really enjoyable. And he would say to my parents that, I know Phil is a Grey, but to me, he's a, in his family surname.
He's your mother's brother?
A brother-in-law. So he's an uncle by marriage. So he'd sort of considered me one of the family, which as being kind, because I'm not. But, so he was elderly and in ill health, but I'm really, really pleased that I made the decision to visit him in hospital just a few days before he died.
How did he cope with the loss of a son? Because as I've learnt, well, as I know from personal experience, but I keep on, it's being reiterated through and through the course of the series, that's every parent's worst dread, to outlive their children.
They're a very close family, very close family. The siblings and their dad were like the best of friends. And my cousin was quite a character, quite well known. And they were just really, really good mates, with all the honesty and things that that involves. And to lose him was devastating for my uncle, devastating. But this was discussed at his funeral service. He decided that he wasn't going to let that bring him, that wasn't going to destroy him. He wanted to get back out there and continue travelling extensively. He'd travelled a lot with my cousin, and he wanted to carry on doing that, and he did. And he made the remaining sort of 6, 7, 8 years of his life as full as it could possibly be, until he was physically not able to. So, how admirable.
How did he die?
My cousin?
Your uncle.
Oh, my uncle. Just general organ failure from age. So a natural end.
Did that trigger something in you, watching your cousin die, and of course your brother's health challenges? Has that brought certain facts of life home to you even more?
Yeah, just that.
Reminded you of your own vulnerabilities?
It can, certain things can strike people, anybody, at any time. And that's what happened to my brother. So he's in excellent health, fit and active, and not yet 60, and just with almost the flick of a switch. The odds were that he wouldn't make it. In a matter of sort of 36 hours, he wouldn't make it, but he has. He's one of the lucky ones. And it just reminds me that it can happen to anybody, and it does happen to anybody.
How close are you and your brother?
Closer as middle-aged adults onwards than we were in younger years. I've got enormous respect for my brother. He's a very admirable and very kind person. Close.
And how did you feel when you got the news?
Stunned. I was out of the country. And to be away from extended family and my own family, and to hear the news that this is not looking good at all, and then having to try and get back to New Zealand was, that hadn't happened to me before. Very, very worrying.
You know, grief is, we tend to think of grief in a very one-dimensional way, in a very black and white way, but grief affects us in many, many ways and in many aspects of our lives. Mm. I've just been talking to a woman who's been caring for her 18-year-old cerebral palsy son all his life, and she talks about the grief of her having to give up her life to care for him, and the grief that she has for him, that he won't have the life that her other son will have. He won't ever have a wife. He won't ever have a university degree. He'll never get a chance to travel. Do you have you got any perspectives on grief that you'd like to share?
I don't think I have any great perspectives, because I haven't had profound experiences of grief. You know, I haven't lost a parent. I haven't lost a life partner or a child. Probably the most grief-struck I've been, I mean, of course, there's grandparents and uncles and things. I think one of the grief things that are underestimated, or in fact completely misunderstood and ignored by a lot of people, is the grief of losing a pet, actually. You know, they're a member of the family, and not everybody sees it the same way, but losing a pet that you've had for its life and is in some ways they become the centre of your life in a strange way because they rely on you. Very, very difficult to do. But also, yes, I have lost a few friends over the last few years, and each of those has been experienced in a different way.
I'm really pleased that you brought up the subject of our companion animals, because I hear this comes up a lot, especially with people who are suffering a terminal illness. Often the thing that concerns them the most above everything else is what's going to happen to my cat or my dog. You know, what choices do I have? Can I trust that somebody else is going to love them like I do, or do is it best to have them euthanized and for them to die with me?
I don't think there's a right or wrong answer with that. Every situation is different, and sometimes the euthanization of an older pet who's only known one person probably is the kindest thing, depending on the animal. But yeah, absolutely a worry for people.
It's interesting too. You know, we've been having this debate in society for maybe 2 or 3 years. You know, people are now starting to ask for grief leave when their pet dies from work. They can have a week off to mourn. And some people think that's absolutely absurd.
As I would expect they would, yeah.
But other people understand that. Yesterday, I looked at one of my cats, and she'd not been well, and I saw her. I think I already knew, but I didn't want to admit it to myself. And I looked at her, and I thought, she's dying, and I can't let her go on. And I just packed her into the car and took her to the vets yesterday morning, and it's an awful thing, you know. It's an awful thing to make that decision for them, am I doing the right thing? And then you grapple with all that and go through with it and hold them while they die, and of course it just casts the shadow over your day. And
yeah, absolutely.
And I'll feel it for a long time yet. And I think you're quite right. The grief that you experience when you lose your companion animal is every bit as valid as when you lose a person in your life. I don't make that distinction. I think we have a healthier way of dealing with it because we do have that choice. You know, we can say, I don't want to see you suffer anymore.
Yes, you can come back to your house, or often the hardest is that first day coming home from work and they're not there. But you can, if you did make the choice, you can say, you know, I'm okay with this because I know it was the kindest thing. I know I did the right thing. And that's comforting to
have had that
agency. Yeah.
You've got Nico at the moment. Mm. How many other dogs have you had in your life?
I've had two other dogs in my life, yeah.
Do you still think about them?
Absolutely, yes, yes. The last dog, we had to rush to the vet and plead with them to end his life, like, immediately, put him out of his suffering. He was in cardiac and respiratory distress, and we just didn't want to see that continue. And it was incredibly hard, incredibly hard. We knew it was the right thing, but adapting to life here each day without him being here it took a while. And of course it must be so much more significant when it's a life partner or a child. I mean, I can't imagine. Well, I can't imagine. I haven't experienced it.
Does that ever worry you?
Yeah, sometimes I find myself sitting thinking, what would I do? What would I do with the rest of my life? What would I do? Would I stay living here? What kind of place would I move to? Would I move somewhere else? What would my life look like eventually? And your mind starts wandering and, I don't know. It's strange pondering what a future might be like when you're perfectly happy with the life you have.
Some people never think about these things. They never contemplate their own deaths. They never think about what it would be like if I lost a child or I lost my life partner. But part of me thinks it's actually a very healthy thing to do, because in some ways it doesn't come out, if it does happen, it doesn't come out of the blue, because you've actually reflected on it And in some ways, you prepared yourself emotionally in a small way.
Mm.
Am I right or wrong?
I think you're right. I suspect that if you're in a situation where, I don't know, let's say I've always wanted to live by the beach. I'm not saying that's me, but I've always wanted to live by the beach. I've always wanted a compact house with one spare room I can set up as my hobby room, and I want to decrease my number of working hours, or I want to take the option to work remotely, and you know, whatever. They've kind of got it figured out what actually is feasible, can be done. And they go, if it was me by myself, that would be what I'd like to do. I think if you have that in your mind, surely that's got to help if you were unfortunate enough to lose the person you were with, if you were with somebody, because you should never feel guilty to go, right, okay, this has happened, I'm grieving, I'm going to continue to do that, but in a couple of years, I've got this idea, this thing I've always wanted to do, and I think I'll go and do that now. It's got to be a healthy thing.
I've spoken to people who are absolutely lost after losing a spouse.
Mm.
And what you've just said has perhaps reinforced this idea that, some people are very uncomfortable with that kind of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
They think, you know,
it always feels like cheating.
It feels like cheating, or, you know, how dare you? You know, you've really got to be...
How dare you be making plans with what you're going to do with our money from selling this house?
And getting on with your life.
Mm.
You know, you've got to be wearing sackcloth and ashes for the next 20 years.
Mm.
But I think it's also realistic.
Yes. Well, it's realistic because you do have to think about your financial security. And, you know, living in a house the size of the house we have, if it was just me, or if it was my wife and I had dropped off, might be really nice, but isn't really the right thing. You know, let's move on and let a big family move in here and go and do something else. And go and live. You've always wanted to live by the beach. Go and do it.
I've lost a sister. Mm. I've experienced that grief. Mm. And my memories of it are... The pain was so intense, so overwhelming, that I promised myself, as I started to come out of it, I would never, ever allow myself to feel that way again.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to Jill, who's on this podcast series, the other day, and when she lost her daughter at the age of 21 in a car accident, she said exactly the same thing. It was so overwhelmingly painful that she said, for the rest of my life, I pushed people away because I didn't want to be close to anybody else. I didn't want to know. I didn't want to have that knowledge that if something happened to them, I would feel this way again.
Mm.
I have two stepchildren.
Mm.
And they're out and about in the world. They go all over the place. And they're busy, cosmopolitan people with interesting, complex jobs. And I don't dwell on them at all. I'm pleased that they're having great lives. But every now and again, it slips into the corner of my psyche that how would I feel if one of them was killed?
Mm.
And I can't help but think that.
Mm.
But I don't really want to.
Mm. Mm. There's nothing wrong with letting your mind roam and contemplate those scenarios.
Do you have that fear?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. You don't want to contemplate it. But there's nothing wrong with contemplating it. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with thinking, how might you cope? Who might you reach out to? What professional services might you tap into? It's just planning. Not planning for something you think is going to happen. It's just getting some thoughts together. So when you are in that grief situation, maybe you've already taken the first step. Because you've thought about it a little bit, the odd time, 3 o'clock in the morning when you can't sleep, whatever. You've at least let your mind go there. I think that's a positive.
You got sick. You get, say you got sick. and you're given 6 months to live.
Mm.
And your oncologist said to you, "It's we can treat it for a while. We can keep it at bay, but by about month four, it's going to be very painful, and we'll be able to mitigate most of that pain, but not all of it. You're facing an uncomfortable death. Would you investigate the assisted dying option?"
"Yes, absolutely, without a question. My understanding is limited, although I know people that have gone down that path. I think there's a general feeling that you just say to your doctor, sign me up, let me know when I can do it. I believe, from my limited knowledge, that it's a lot more complex than that, and you've got to meet a whole lot of criteria to be eligible.
It's not, if you have a terminal illness like cancer, it's not terribly complicated.
Okay.
And as long as two doctors agree, but you have to pick the day yourself.
Right. And I guess you've got to turn up.
Or they turn up to see you.
Right.
You choose where you want it to how you want to die and when you want to die. I've often sat and thought, okay, I get a terminal diagnosis. I can't imagine picking that day.
Yeah, and I've thought about that recently with a situation, which I don't want to go into, of an acquaintance who did exactly that. And I was thinking, how must that have been for him? And I came down to that exact same thing. How bizarre to choose the day and watch the calendar and watch the clock. What a truly bizarre final experience it must be.
You don't have any problem with the idea of assisted dying?
No. No, it's the only thing that a civilized society would not argue over. Yeah, look, I mean, I understand the differing viewpoints and I understand where they come from. I ain't got no time for that. It's what we do with our animals that we love. It's absolutely what we should do with the people we love should be allowed to do.
The question was asked of me the other day in the context of this podcast. A woman who'd watched her father die from Alzheimer's had said to me, "I'd like to have this conversation. Why do we let people linger with dementia and Alzheimer's? Why can't they have the option of an assisted death?" Yesterday, talking to Gary Verburn, he talked about his own mother dying from dementia, and I put this question to him. And it was a very interesting discussion because it's very complicated, because that person doesn't have the faculty to say, yes, I want to die. That's got to be made for them, and that's where it gets prickly.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a reasonable conversation to have, though?
Yes, I do. You know, there's moral and ethical things to consider, but again, you know, direct family experience of exactly that situation, a long, slow, lingering death, that it would have been far kinder to bring that to an end at least a year earlier. But that couldn't be done. And I don't know how we make progress on that one, where the individual isn't making the choice. That's a very tricky one.
You have to be very careful, because there are people with nefarious motives. Maybe I want to get my hands on my inheritance a bit quicker.
Yeah, sure. And for me, this whole thing of what would I do if it was me, part of it, let's say the situation was my care was costing $2,000 a week. Am I getting any benefit lingering for some unhappy, uncomfortable extra 3 months, say, depleting the assets which I would delight in passing on to my son? You know, I part of me goes, I would rather bring this to an end sooner and let other people that I love enjoy that money, use it wisely, blow it, party, holiday, whatever, rather than it just be gone into the ether or into the healthcare system to some multinational looking after me. Now, you know, there are people, there are groups that argue vociferously against assisted dying. And part of it is that, you know, that concern over money-hungry relatives and the rest of it. It's different when it's you talking about your own money and going, you know, I don't want this to be wasted on keeping me hanging on. I want you to go and have fun with it, or go and, you know, put it towards your house deposit or whatever it's going to be. That to me would be an honourable and beneficial and comforting thing to do. Yeah.
Because the other perspective is the religious one. God gives life and only God has the right to take life away. Mm-hmm. One of the things I've learnt through the course of this podcast is that people who have made the decision to have an assisted death have had to keep it very quiet. Mm. Only one or two people in the family knew, people they really trusted, because they knew that they had relatives of an opposing perspective. And the last thing they wanted after having made a very difficult decision was to have to argue and debate with people. And that has happened to some. Mm. They've been confronted, they've been emotionally abused.
Yep.
They've had to fight a fight they didn't want to fight. And I'm thinking, yes, you're allowed to have your perspective. But if a person's made a choice, do you have the right to undermine that choice?
I think one of the reasons for that choice can also be, though, that if somebody says, you know, I've got a couple of weeks left until the day, I want this to be spent with just my nearest and dearest. I don't have the energy and I don't have the emotional resilience to have an endless stream of people arriving at my bedroom door wanting to come and say their goodbyes. You know, imagine if you only had X number of days, and, you know, without disrespecting all the people that want to come and say their goodbyes, if you just don't have it in you to do that, or you don't want them to see you like that, choosing the date and keeping it quiet, I think, quite understandably, can be for that reason. But this other issue of people trying to change your mind and arguing with you about it, well, that's going to happen. That's going to happen. But, yeah, sometimes people just need to keep their beliefs and prejudices to themselves.
What happens when you die, Phil?
You're not here anymore. What happens before you're born?
Do you have...
It's the same. It's the same as before you're born.
You don't have a belief system?
I don't have... I have many beliefs. I have many beliefs. If you're talking about a religious or spiritual or supernatural-based belief system, no. No, I have a set of beliefs, but not a belief system, no. So I am an atheist, and atheism isn't a belief system. It's simply the lack of believing in one thing. In fact, not even one thing. It's the lack of believing in a God, just like all Christians don't believe in the thousands of gods that have existed and do exist in other people's minds. You know, it's a cliche to say it, and it's a celebrity-based cliche to say, I'm the same as a Christian. I just don't believe in one more God than them.
A lot of people find great comfort in the idea that when they die, they're going to find themselves in a beneficent afterworld.
Oh, understandably. Sounds wonderful.
It doesn't frighten you that when you die, that's it. You're gone. You're wiped.
No. You know, I don't want to be dismissive and I don't want to insult anybody, but it'd also be pretty bloody frightening to think you're going to stand around on clouds. I mean, you know, people that believe that they're going to heaven, well, what does that look like? Is it the same as being on Earth, or are you actually floating around on the clouds, getting wet? I mean, sounds silly, sounds trite, and actually probably quite offensive to say it, but no, there's nothing to fear. It's simply the lack of existing, just like before you were born.
So it doesn't worry you at all?
No. No. Not, I mean, I'd rather exist than not exist, but it's inevitable that we all don't exist when we die. So I won't exist.
So we're back to where we started. You're accepting of your inevitable death.
Yeah. Ultimately, I think it comes back to, what are we here for? I'm not here for any reason whatsoever. I wasn't put here. I wasn't magicked up by a guy in the clouds. I wasn't reincarnated from something else through a massively complex and lengthy evolutionary process. I happen to be lucky enough to be here. And that doesn't mean I'm here for a reason. We make reason. You know, through our lives, we make reason. You might feel, oh, I'm terribly important. I do all these wonderful things. Brilliant. Great. But you've done that. Not you weren't put here to, to progress society. We develop these social systems that give us meaning and give us purpose in our lives, and that's what it's all about. But I wasn't put here for a reason. I'm part of a almost unbelievably complex and vast natural world. And like every organism that's ever existed in this natural world, I will cease to exist.
Yeah, Pākehā New Zealanders, don't tend to generally talk about death. I think that's because, not in my own backyard, it hasn't really concerned them. If perhaps they have had a lot of experience with death, then they have to wrangle with it, acclimatise themselves to it. I think Māori cosmology has a lot more to say about it. It's involved way more in the culture. We tend to sort of dramatise death, see it as abnormal and weird and involving suffering and horror. And death is not associated with rebirth. It's not... Endings are feared instead of easily let go of, and the way of the Jedi is to let go of that which is lost. So I definitely think it would be helpful to talk about it, and particularly rather than just talking about death, which is a really natural, beautiful thing, especially in the composting process, it's also dealing with endings, dealing with finality, dealing with things that are out of our control and being comfortable with that, but also dealing with grief rather than just death itself. So for those reasons, I think it's not culturally embraced. It's not looked forward to. It's feared. It's feared, which was what I was talking about before. Do I think about my own death? Not one bit. There's something that you fear? Not at all. Why? Or if not, why not? I don't fear it because it's for the people left behind. What I do is I do think about suicide, and the reason why I'm putting an end to it, that has less to do with the death aspect. In fact, death is seen therefore as a remedy. It's more to do with the difficulty of the life aspect, which is, I think, really what death then becomes, a release and a relief. But as I was saying before, it's not about death. It's about what death does to our understanding of life. A lot of people are already dead because they're not living, and they don't know what life is, and they don't know what gives them life brings them life. They're basically just in a slow process of dying, and that's all they talk about and think about. And from the people I know who do fear dying, they're the ones who are in grave health because they think about it so much. So whatever they're thinking about is the law of attraction, and it expands and grows bigger. What are your thoughts about assisted dying? Is it something you would choose for yourself? Yeah, as I said, I don't think I would choose it for myself. Nah. Yeah, and I also don't believe in a do not resuscitate. I'm saying no resuscitate. give me as many chances as I need. Try your best anyway. And what are my thoughts about assisted dying? It is people's right. Yeah, each to their own, and power to them if they wish to. But I do not believe we want to give any state authorities, and certainly not the family, the capacity to. I mean, a really good example is Lady Gaga's documentary, where she's got her auntie called Joanne, and she named her album, one of her albums, after it. And she had lupus, which is something where you can easily live with lupus. You know, it's something that we can do a lot about. The thing was, her hands were going to be amputated, and the grandmother, Joanne's mother, decided it was better, therefore, to kill her. I'm going, whoa, no, that's not the case. I mean, by all means, do a Darth Vader rebuild. Use some, I was going to say antibiotics, but it's more, what do you call it? Bionics, sorry. Antibionics? No, I'm not antibionic. Okay, so is there life after death? Yeah, I think life just continues. I don't think death of the material body has anything to do with this, which is back to the Buddhism, I am not this body, I am not this body, I am not this body. We are just spirits having a material experience. But for me, I don't believe the experience I'm having is a material experience, because all of that has been very, very, very blurred, the lines between realms and dimensions. So I exist very much in the 5D, with co-creational capacities that we all have, such that we aren't just at the effect of the material world we live in. We actually are able to shift and change our reality to based on our perspective. So yeah, I would say yes, there's life after death, because life is eternal. Do you have a particular experience of grief you would like to share? Well, interestingly enough, yeah, I guess that was my experience with my father. I do believe that you can get closer to thinking about someone, and everyone likes to be thought about. And what thinking about someone does is it draws them to you. So angels being thoughts. And around grief, yeah, that needs a lot more discussion, because grief, even dealing with funerals, because I went from being New Zealand's wedding singer in the 90s to being New Zealand's funeral singer now. And in fact, a couple of weeks ago, I was singing at a friend's husband's funeral, and I do not know how the song came to be suggested, because I didn't know a waiata that she was saying I sent to her. And I'm going, nope, I've never heard of this thing. But because I'm legally blind, I have to memorize songs, and I can't cheat by looking at the lyrics. But I can't do that with a te reo song, because it's a waiata, and I'm not fluent. I can sing in it, but I'm not fluent. So I just practiced, and it was only 3 days' notice, because I was going, no, hold on, someone's got this wrong. I did not suggest this song. And rather than just resisting it, I went, okay, maybe someone's ancestors were really keen to have me sing this song. On the day of the actual funeral, I had a genius idea that I was going to sellotape my large printed out, large Sharpie pen lyrics of Tai Aroha, not Te Aroha, Tai Aroha. And and so I could actually put it really close to my face, read the lyrics, perform on a diagonal so that it didn't obscure my vision because it was to the left. And so it worked. It was a really amazing logistic thing. Around grief, though, we need to get comfortable in the shared experience of it. Having sung at a lot of funerals as well and deal with a lot of death, as I've said, what I believe happens is the whatever the fire that was within that person is then transmuted like an Olympic torch to the survivors, to the rest of us. And their fire, their purpose, what their life was about can then be adopted by us, and we become the standard bearers and the torch bearers and the keepers of the flame. So I know that from my experience with funerals as well, that the circle becomes closer when someone leaves it. We gather closer with the departure of one or many. What has loss and grief taught you about yourself? Ooh, I think we all need to be humbled by the fact that we really need to surrender to life and the great mystery and the master plan, rather than resist it and rally against it and rage against it and try and control it. Because it is perfect. Whatever it is perfect. We don't realize it's perfect, but like with the many people I know who I've lost, yeah, they become more available to you. So for example, my father, who was 89 when he passed, he wasn't happy. He'd become a little bit institutionalized to the aged care correctional facility he was in, though he kept running away, and God bless him for jailbreaks. I tried to assist him with that when he was in hospital for many years. But anyway, quite successfully too. He was more available to me in spirit form than he was in physical form, because he was much depleted. Obviously, his health, his strength, you know, very reduced. But what an amazing innings. And the thing is, though, when people pass, because they're in spirit form, they're able to be omnipresent. They are able to be with you. They can give you so much guidance and direction and intercession, and they can give you signs. And that's back to the angels as well. You can work with them. That's what I do. I basically ask directly, hey, look, if you're going to have any signs, make them obvious, make your voice loud and clear. And also, obviously, angels are the voice of love. So you can tell the difference between your supposed interpretation, because if it's a voice that's telling you to do something, it's probably not an angel. And an angelic voice can be also the adopted voice of self-soothing. It helps. It doesn't matter where it originated. We need to parent ourselves. If we didn't have supportive parents, we need to be the ones to self-soothe. But you know what? I even had an experience with ancestors yesterday, where I was actually putting my hand up when I was out walking to feel my nose, and I heard the angelic or the ancestral realm just say, "We made that." And it was like they were really proud of my nose. I just thought, TMI, I have too many experiences to share, but that, I hope, answered some of those questions.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.